was late and said at another meeting and unfortunately ran over. We left off on these bills, Senate Bill 49, 300, and 303, having had most of the proponents talk about the bill, and today is the day to set aside so that we could have those persons who disagree with the bills come forward and spend some time talking to us. So we don't have a huge sign-up list, unfortunately. Kevin Sterrett, you're first up. And well, we're going to do like a public hearing on all of them. So I've kind of given up trying to be systematic here. It's not working. Okay.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Sterrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. I assume we can discuss both 49 and 300.
Yes, we're going to do an open hearing on all three of them. So.
Members of the committee, in spite of how they've been promoted, the bills in question here are gun control bills, pure and simple. The testimony we heard on Monday made that perfectly clear. Lisa Nato referenced three victims of domestic violence, Winolyn Burnell, Magellan, Christina Getty, and Miss Lonnie Feathers, who appeared. And while our stories were tragic, they were also immaterial to the bills in question, since the bills deal with confiscating the property of people against whom restraining orders have been issued. In none of these three instances was that the case. So while the stories were compelling and disturbing, they were also irrelevant. Miss Feathers testified that she had no warning that her boyfriend was violent, that he simply snapped and shot her. And while this kind of behavior is virtually unknown, remains a mystery why she or the proponents of these bills believe that the implementation of these new restrictions on constitutional rights would have had any effect on her personal situation. Feathers testified that a woman is battered every 9 seconds in this country. She cited no source for this figure, but let's assume it's true. That's 3,504,000 instances of domestic violence. One would think that with a number of abused women being that high, the supporters of these bills would have been able to cite a single instance where the proposed legislation would have made a difference. Oddly, they did not. Ms. Feathers testified that she, quote, didn't know if any of these bills would have prevented her from getting shot. Well, I can answer that question. Clearly, they would not have. I cannot fathom the agony that Steve Dole and his family must have suffered at the loss of his daughter. It's a nightmare that I pray daily I will never experience. But Mr. Dole testified that to people who suffer that kind of loss at the hands of a depraved criminal, the weapon doesn't matter. But obviously it does. Mr. Dole knows better than anyone what kind of damage can be done with a common item like a car, but the proponents of these bills seem unconcerned about anything except a person's firearms. The testimony from Camilla Sugar, the assistant district attorney from Lane County, was even harder to comprehend. Ms. Sugar made the claim that while it was true that these bills would not have helped Lonnie Feathers, they would have helped the, quote, next girlfriend of Lonnie's attacker because he would have been forbidden from having firearms. But according to Ms. Feathers, her attacker is in prison on attempted murder and kidnapping charges. One would assume that that would be sufficient to prohibit him from future firearms ownership. Ms. Sugar believes that these bills would be required to achieve that. How Ms. Sugar believes that these bills would be required to achieve that mystifies me, especially coming from someone tasked with enforcing the law. But even more disturbing was Ms. Sugar's comments in response to Chairman Minnis' stated concerns about upholding the Constitution. Ms. Sugar replied that there were a lot of laws that had been on the books that we wouldn't want to have now. By way of example, she cited the, quote, rule of thumb, a law she claimed was part of England's legal code in the 1600s, which allowed a man to beat his wife as long as the rod he used was no larger than his thumb. Again, compelling and disturbing testimony, and also a complete fabrication. I've attached documentation from feminist author Christina Hoff Summers that traces the creation of this utterly false assertion. That information took me all of 30 seconds to find using an internet search engine. It's particularly unsettling that this fabrication was repeated to you as fact, especially by a person who's not only an officer of the court, but someone charged with prosecuting men in domestic violence cases. Finally, I'd like to respond to the testimony of Brian DeLashmet and Liz Carruthers of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Their opposition arose not out of any fear for the rights of citizens, but only for the job security of their members. And while Officer Carruthers correctly pointed out that these new laws could be used as a tool by a vindictive spouse, I can't help but wonder why that would only be likely if the petitioner were married to a police officer. I know of no constitutional guarantee of job security for police. I do know, however, about constitutional protections for gun ownership and against the seizure of property. That's all these bills are about, and I urge you to let them die here.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sterrett. Any questions from the committee? So here we go.
Thank you for testifying, Mr. Sterrett. You know, last week on these bills, I asked folks, what is the answer to the gun violence in our society? Excuse me. You know, some people say enforce the gun laws on the books, and the gentleman who is representing the police chief of the state of Oregon said he's not aware of our not enforcing gun laws on the books. But I am wondering, what's your suggestion?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, I don't believe that any law that you can write will address the darkness in someone's heart. But there was testimony on Monday from Lee Anderson, and I don't know how it was received by the committee. I stepped out at that point, but the answer to that may be better addressed by a sociologist. But from the standpoint of people like myself, I've been involved in helping Mr. Anderson in taking people who are potentially victims of violence and giving them the tools to protect themselves, because there really is no guarantee that anyone else can do it.
I understand that if there's 11,000 gun deaths in the United States a year, you're not here to offer any answer or to make any suggestions.
Well, I believe the answer is that people, you know, we hear about these instances that are described as somebody suddenly, a perfectly normal person, suddenly snaps and shoots his girlfriend in the head three times. Frankly, I find that a little hard to believe. I believe that there are warnings when people are going to behave badly. I also believe that there are an awful lot of people who have displayed those warning signs who are still walking the street. And unfortunately, although I think there are way too many people in prison on minor charges, I think there are way too many people walking around who should never have been out of jail, and that the answer is to make sure that dangerous people are not free to walk our streets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sterrett, I want to kind of direct you back to, I think, what is the focus of the bills, and they may be flawed in terms of how they're constructed, but I'm thinking of an instance or instances where a person does have a restraining order and there is some demonstration that there is a violence that's occurred in that family. Are you suggesting to the committee that under no circumstances should firearms be dispossessed of that particular person? And I want to get to the point of the domestic violence situation. I know we had some interesting testimony that didn't seem to be very well connected, but thinking of it as a police officer, when you do intervene in a situation that looks explosive, it looks like it's going to deteriorate or get out of hand, is there a place within which you feel there should be dispossession of a handgun?
Certainly. I think that any situation that calls for an arrest, we call for that. The problem is, as you probably know better than anybody, if you are in a position to take away a firearm from a dangerous individual, in the absence of incarcerating that person, you do nothing to render him less dangerous. The fact is that if a restraining order was brought against me, you would have no way of knowing how many guns I actually owned. And if you had the ability to take those guns, I had the ability to get another one in about 20 minutes. And as a result of that, I'm no less dangerous. If a person is really dangerous to their intimate partner, that person has to be incarcerated. And there's nothing that you're going to take from that person that's going to serve any purpose. I mean, it'll make people feel better, but the fact is that it hasn't denied him or her the ability to be dangerous.
And I understand what you're saying. It does at least make it a 20 minutes more difficult to go get another gun, I suppose. And I have been in a situation where you have a domestic violence circumstance, and there are weapons in the house. And we have taken them for safekeeping and put them in, you know, storage lockers. They're ultimately released later after the situation's resolved. But, I mean, do you help me understand what you're saying about an arrest? Because, you know, we have mandatory domestic violence arrest statute. So under that circumstance, would you suggest that?
Well, I believe that on the circumstances of arrest, you probably have broader powers to take away.
Well, I think that's a little bit obscure, too. I mean, for instance, you can take a weapon, if somebody's threatened somebody with a weapon or says, I'm going to shoot you with one of my guns, then the one of the guns in the immediate possession of the suspect might be evidence. But there are circumstances under which where the evidence or the guns that you're talking about may not be the very weapon that was described or verbalized by the suspect who's now being taken into custody. There may be other weapons that are equally as dangerous there. That I think in the eyes of law enforcement, there's a sense that if you can minimize the potential threat, that it would be prudent to do that.
Well, I agree with that, the concept. Unfortunately, the really painful reality of this is that, as people like Steve Dole should know, as many examples that I'm sure you've experienced, if a person is willing to hurt somebody else, you can find and confiscate every single firearm in their house or possession, and you haven't made them any less dangerous. So while it would seem on the surface foolish to allow that person to keep a gun, unless you're willing to confiscate every piece of cutlery they had, every piece of sporting equipment, every power tool, you haven't rendered them any less dangerous. And that may be a horrible reality, but it is a reality.
Okay. And not to be argumentative, I'm kind of going back to my college days where I know there were some studies done that where firearms were available, the likelihood of violence did increase, as opposed to a chair.
I'd like to see those studies because I think
I was in college 26 years ago. So
what you might find though is that what they really proved was that when a firearm was available, a firearm was more likely to be used. But I don't think you'll find any evidence that where a firearm's taken away, the person is suddenly rendered harmless.
Okay, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with you, sir, that if you take their firearm away, it doesn't mean they're any less harmless, but it takes away the opportunity to pick up a weapon and shoot someone with it. Now, I would ask you, I do a lot of work on youth suicide prevention. When you have a depressed youth who has expressed an interest in taking their own life, a prudent parent would remove all firearms from the home, any medications that are in the cupboard or closet, and those sorts of things, because those are the top number one ways that a young person will take their own life. First one is a gun, and you don't survive very often from shooting yourself when you're trying to kill yourself. Though I have seen a young man who's had half of his head blown off when he tried to kill himself. He survived. So I'm just saying that your argument doesn't make a lot of sense, because you do want to take the weapon away so that it's not readily available. But when you come and argue that this is gun control, it's like you never seem to feel that just because we're going to restrict access to the gun, I mean, the conclusion is always reached that this is gun control. This is gun control. Nothing short of that. And I just can never see where we can come together and agree that at some point you have to remove a weapon. And I don't see that that you have an agreement on that.
No, I don't. As I stated when I started, I believe this is gun control. And the simple fact is that adolescent suicide, as tragic as it is, has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. And the fact is that most people who would be affected by this legislation are not likely, as you heard the testimony from the gentleman on Monday, how his life has been ruined, and the testimony from the police officers on Monday, the potential for lives to be ruined because of vindictive spouses. And while, yes, taking guns out of a house removes the possibility of somebody being shot, at least until another gun is acquired, it does nothing to reduce the possibility of them being stabbed or hit in the head with a hammer. And violent people are capable of violence irrespective of the tools at their disposal. And what our concern is for all the people to whom this should not apply, to whom it will.
Let me ask you this question. What if someone used a gun in an act of domestic violence and the spouse went and got a restraining order and the husband was dispossessed of his weapon? Do you think that's fair?
Well, Chairman and Senator Walker, first of all, I would prefer not to always assume it's going to be the husband, but one assumes that if someone uses a gun in an act of violence, they've committed a felony and they're going to be arrested and be dispossessed of their firearms anyway.
No, sir, that's not accurate. Let me give you an example. My sister's husband held a shotgun to her head while she was cooking breakfast. No evidence that he would ever have done such a thing. He got angry when he came in drunk. He went in the closet, got a shotgun, and put it to her head. She wrestled him to the floor. Her son, 10 years old, came in and saw this altercation. There was no felony here. She got a restraining order. He was dispossessed of his weapon. And you don't think that's fair?
No, Senator, I didn't say that. That's what you said. I said that under those circumstances, of course it would make sense. And my understanding of Oregon statute is that it's already a crime to point a firearm at another person, loaded or unloaded. So this, your brother-in-law was guilty of a crime, should have been arrested and charged with it. And this would have been entirely redundant in this case. A case like that, a person who does that, of course they should be dispossessed of their firearms. But as you pointed out on Monday, he wasn't dispossessed of it. He was dispossessed of that firearm and has access to other firearms. And none of this would address that. And I'm hard-pressed to believe that a person could commit a crime like that and the police ignore it. And if they do ignore it, then that's the problem I think you should be addressing, the police ignoring an obvious and very dangerous crime.
Thank you.
I think the dialogue is good. Now, Kevin, I'd like to maybe address the other issue of once a restraining order is issued and someone cannot possess firearms. I'm trying to remember, this is an area of the law I'm not very familiar with, but it seems like people kind of get caught up in this in perpetuity that they can never seem to get out of it once they get into it. Are you prepared to talk about any of those issues?
Well, it certainly is an issue that would be of concern to us. The gentleman who was here, the rancher who spoke on Monday, described how his wife kept renewing this restraining order in spite of the fact that criminal charges were being placed against her.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's a real concern, that this will, as Officer Carruthers pointed out, that this is so easy to manipulate and use as a tool against somebody. And the fact is I don't buy the common, well, if it saves just one life thing, because the fact is it typically costs more lives than it saves. But what this bill purports to address, which is domestic violence, it doesn't address. It doesn't prevent. Taking an item away from a dangerous person does not render them less dangerous. So while it may be, you know, it may be a score for the gun control lobby to have passed this, the fact is no one's going to be any safer. I mean, the testimony, I think, of Lonnie Feathers proves that beyond any doubt. Here's supposedly a person with no criminal history, no indication of any kind of violence, and this woman suffered 3 gunshot wounds. So how does this... Dale Penn was talking about a guy who kidnapped his girlfriend, shot her, and then killed himself. This guy was a reserve police officer at one time. I'm hard-pressed to believe that because someone got a restraining order, which apparently there was another restraining order against this guy, that the person willing to commit both murder and suicide would abide by a law that said he couldn't be in possession of a firearm.
Well, I think the logic is fairly clear. I appreciate that. Any other questions?
Just one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made a comment, sir, just a moment ago that it would cost more lives than it saves if we pass this bill. Can you explain
that? No, I didn't say that, Senator.
Why does it cost more lives than it saves? So
actually, you did say something.
I said was that I don't buy into the common idea of saying we should pass something because it might save just one life, because in many cases it costs more lives than it saves. For example, I wasn't referring to this specific legislation. The point I was trying to make was that we will hear that something like this is a benefit because it might just save one life, something that never has to be proven because we never demonstrate whose life was saved by any of these laws. But a person, for example, a vindictive spouse gets a restraining order. The other spouse gets a restraining order against the first spouse. Now, both of these people are dispossessed of firearms, and perhaps one of those people will be in a situation sometime when a firearm may have been the only thing that could have protected their lives, like the children in Merced, California, who were pitchforked to death because their father's gun was locked up. So there we had a lockup law because we were going to save just one life and 2 little children are dead as a result of it. That was the point I was trying to make.
Thank you.
Thanks for the clarification. Appreciate it. All right, we'll go on to Susan Russell, a couple of defense lawyers. And Andrea, are you going to come up too?
Thank you. All right, who's leading off?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bill 49 with some suggestions for improving some of the problems as we foresee them. Our first concern is that Senate Bill 49 does not define who is to determine whether an assault conviction involves domestic violence or how this determination is to be made. Senate Bill 49 simply requires that the person has been convicted of assault in the fourth degree, and these are the words it uses, and the insult involved domestic violence as defined in ORS 135230. Domestic violence is widely defined under Oregon law as abuse between family or household members, and the statute, in fact, goes on to define what those relations can be. Assault in the fourth degree encompasses a wide array of behavior. It includes reckless behavior with minor injury. Given the breadth of the assault four statute, it's our position that it may be appropriate for a judge to have discretion in imposing a firearm restriction, and also for the judge to have discretion in determining the appropriate length of a firearm restriction. Senate Bill 49's lack of standards and procedures for determining the issue of domestic violence contrasts with Senate Bill 303. In Senate Bill 303, it's provided that the words constituting domestic violence may be added to the title of the crime only when the accusatory instrument has been pled and the prosecution has proved at trial that domestic violence was an element of the crime. And it's our position that would be an appropriate addition to Senate Bill 49, that it should require a similar requirement that the gun restriction, the firearm restriction, would only apply on assault for conviction if it was pled and proved at trial. Our second concern is that Senate Bill 49 limits or restricts an individual's constitutional right to bear arms without adequate notice and due process. Defendants may not be represented by an attorney in the assault four proceeding. They may be unaware that an assault four conviction prohibits firearm possession. Generally, firearm prohibitions do not apply to misdemeanors. The court is under no obligation to inform the defendant of the firearm prohibition. This contrasts with other sentencing provisions where the court is actually required to inform the defendant of the consequences of conviction or the restrictions of conviction, such as the requirement to report as a sex offender. With respect to the restraining order provision of Senate Bill 49, Senate Bill 49 provides that the respondent is prohibited from possessing a firearm while the restraining order is in effect. This restriction is found in a two-line statement in a multiple-page document, the restraining order document, to be served on the respondent. This respondent may not read the entire document or be unaware of this provision. The respondent may choose not to contest the restraining order for a number of reasons without realizing the significant restrictions this order will place on his or her right to possess firearms. The firearm prohibition applies to restraining order in addition before the respondent has had any opportunity to be heard in a contested hearing. A hearing can be set as late as 21 days from the time a respondent requests a hearing. This contrasts with the provisions of the federal firearm, the firearm provisions of the Federal Family Abuse Prevention Act. Under the federal act, firearm restrictions only apply where a restraining order was issued after a hearing of which such person received actual notice and at which the person had the opportunity to participate. I think the committee has before them a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 49, Amendment-2. I believe that this amendment is seeking to ameliorate this situation by providing that the firearm prohibition applies only when a restraining order has been continued after a hearing. We support an amendment to that effect, but would suggest that the language could be clearer in the -2 amendment to make it clear that not only has the person requested a hearing, but that a hearing has in fact been held or that the respondent has had an opportunity to be heard. On page 17 of the Senate Bill 49, there is the actual notice within the restraining order. And again, we would propose that that be amended to provide that the order, while this order, any order continuing or changing this order is in effect, you are prohibited from possessing a firearm, that words to the effect of after a hearing or after the respondent has had an opportunity to be heard be added to that.
All right. Any questions of Susan? Senator Byrd.
Thank you. Your testimony is restricted to Senate Bill 49.
That's correct.
Have you reviewed Senate Bill 300 as well, which is a related bill?
Correct. And we take no position on Senate Bill 300.
You take no position on Senate Bill 300. Specifically, I was wondering in terms of your last point about the hearing and your concerns about putting in a gun restriction before a hearing is held. In Senate Bill 300, that the victim is allowed, along with the accused person, the victim is allowed to request a hearing. And is that, do you have a position on that particular provision?
With respect to it being incorporated into Senate Bill 49, we would not be opposed to a provision in Senate Bill 49 which would allow either party to request a hearing.
Thank you.
So. All right, any other questions?
Just one.
Senator Walker and then Senator Rainbow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, most of the time I think what you have to say is really brilliant, and you have a lot of really good points, but I have to tell you that I sort of gasped at one of these when you said that in the restraining order it's a two-line statement telling them that they're being dispossessed for their firearm and they might not read the whole document. I'm supposed to do something about that? I mean, if they're being served with a document, it's incumbent upon the respondent to read it. We can't legislate against them not reading it. We can't protect them against not reading it. Is there some fix to that you'd like us to do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think that would be fixed, or it would certainly be ameliorated if there was an opportunity for either party, the respondent, to be heard prior to this restriction applying. Our concern is that in a document of this length, that to simply put a line in without any opportunity for a hearing, the respondent may not be focused at all on the firearm issue, may be focused on other matters. And it's simply figuring out some way to provide or to increase the notice that is given.
Doesn't the respondent already have a right to request a hearing?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, a respondent has a right to request a hearing, but the firearm provision, a restriction under Senate Bill 49 would apply prior to the hearing taking place. And that hearing may take place up to 21 days after the respondent requests a hearing. If it's the objective of the proponents of Senate Bill 49 to ensure that respondents do not have firearms, that I think that everybody can agree the more notice that the respondent has. I don't think anybody wants the respondent to simply just be unaware of a firearm restriction and to continue to possess firearms. I think everybody should be in agreement, if that's the objective, that notice can't hurt anyone. And how we go about providing more notice or adequate notice, I think, is the question. But I can't see if that's the objective, to under certain limited circumstances, to remove firearms or restrict firearm possession, that the more notice the respondent has, the better the chances must be that the respondent is not going to have firearms.
Thank you.
Senator Rinko.
I wanted to ask, about your comment about perhaps it would be appropriate for the judge to have discretion in imposing a firearm restriction. And I guess that does touch to one of my concerns, and that is I can see circumstances where a restraining order is issued where there is really a high degree of fear that a violent act may occur. Or there may be other cases where the judge would order the restraining order just really out of an abundance of caution that, gee, these people shouldn't see each other. It's not really an issue of violence, but maybe they should just stay away from each other. And yes,
the judge would go ahead and grant the restraining order, and I'm wondering what would be the mechanism for giving the judge that discretion, and what factors would be used?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe at present that the court can address such matters and can tailor restrictions on the parties. What this bill would do, Senate Bill 49, would simply say in all cases, and I think you are correct, Senator Ringo, that there are, because we're talking about the lowest level of domestic violence, meaning the lowest level of conviction, and assault in the fourth degree, the conduct may be, I don't want to say it's a minimal conduct, but it may be less egregious. There may be legitimate reasons in terms of hunting or security. Let's say, for example, that the respondent is employed as a security officer, where the respondent would have legitimate reasons for a firearm, where there really wouldn't be a concern. And so I think that if the committee is interested in pursuing Senate Bill 49, Senate Bill 49 could be amended to allow the judge discretion.
Can you give an example of what you would consider to be a reckless behavior that results in only a minor injury that maybe the person shouldn't be dispossessed of a firearm?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I can give numerous examples. They're very common cases and are often prosecuted. So, for example, if during a domestic argument, if one party pushed another party against a wall and the party that was pushed against the wall received what they call physical injury, which is more than a fleeting pain. It wouldn't require any kind of permanent or long-term or serious injury. It wouldn't even require a bruise, a pain that lasts for more than just a fleeting moment. So those kind of cases where there's an argument is taking place, there may be no history of domestic violence, and there's some minor injury that takes place. It could be also in the reckless, where somebody grabs, say during an argument, that one party grabs another party, never intending to injure the person, but grabs the person in such a manner that, in fact, causes a bruise or some type of more than fleeting pain, but never intended to, was simply...
Mr. Chair?
Senator,
what's the burden of proof required to obtain a restraining order? What's the burden to prove those elements?
I'm hesitating.
I'll ask it a different way. I have no experience with this kind of law, but what I'm wondering is whether if one spouse comes in and gives one story and the other spouse comes in and gives a different story, whether in the real world, the judge is going to say, you know, these people shouldn't see each other and just go ahead and err on the side of issuing the restraining order, or whether the judge is going to be very careful in terms of listening to a lot of evidence and if there's any reasonable doubt, will not issue the restraining order. We're not talking about a reasonable doubt.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator, I hesitate whether it was a preponderance of evidence. It is a lower standard. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's a civil case.
Yeah. Sorry, that's correct. I didn't want to misspeak. Senator Ringo, in my experience in dealing with these kind of cases is that the courts are very cautious in terms of granting restraining orders. I think erring on the side that it's better to have a restraining order in place to protect the petitioner than to not. In domestic violence cases, there is a problem in addressing these for the courts in that often once there is domestic violence, the petitioner wishes to reunite with or interact with the respondent. And so you will often have situations where the petitioner seeks to drop the restraining order. I know in Multnomah County, often the courts are unwilling to drop the restraining order once the restraining order is in place, and they, as I've already been said, last for 1 year. I think there could be serious concerns in terms of the conduct that is the basis of the restraining order, and that it is a lower standard of proof than a criminal case. And there are cases where there's a restraining order without a criminal prosecution.
Thank you.
Susan, I wanted to ask you a question. These bills are specific to firearms, and I think Mr. Sterrett raised the question of other weapons. Is there a reason why we don't, in discussing these things, talk about dispossession of any known weapons, not just exclusively firearms, but knives, nunchuckers, whatever this, you know, if you have a martial arts person who has these kind of weapons, why wouldn't we look at those also?
And, Chairman, I think that's a good consideration and a good question. I think when we're talking about domestic violence situations, what we see is weapons. Weapons is defined very broadly under Oregon law, and what we see often in terms of matters that can cause the most injury, we see sidewalks and we see walls. We see a number of different items being used that can cause, under the circumstances, extremely serious injury. So I think that the problem here, I think, which a number of witnesses have specified, is the conduct. And there are a number of items always at someone's reach if the conduct is there or the problem motivation is there to cause injury. And I've had cases where a wall has done incredible injury when it was being used as a weapon by an individual. And I think perhaps some of the stuff that we're talking about here, I know that there have been some questions about how we go about addressing these problems. In working in the system for so many years, I think it's pretty clear and it's recognized or accepted studies that this is really a learned behavior in terms of the cycles repeating from parent to child. People raised in violent situations grow up to be violent in domestic situations. And I think there is really a good case to be made for continuing increasing early intervention in terms of with children that are in domestic violence situations, and also in terms of early intervention in diversion type agreements in domestic dispute situations with counsel and anger management. So I think that given that weapons are always going to exist and that almost anything can be used as weapons under the circumstances, that really to get at this problem we have to work more at early intervention, including with the children of these situations.
And Susan, if I understand your main point or points is that you want to make sure that whatever product comes out of the committee has a very, very clear and specific due process, I guess. You want to make sure the due process is, in fact, guaranteed and protected here, and that it is clear in any number of forms that you have an opportunity to have a hearing, and that the hearing is in a forum that is fair for both sides.
Chairman, that's a correct summary, and to the extent at all possible that the judge could have some type of discretion, both in terms of the time limits. I mean, these prohibitions would be for life. I take that back. They may not be for life. There are provisions that under a certain time frame a defendant or a respondent could ask for the firearm prohibitions, I believe, to be removed. But
I'm a little perplexed. I'm not sure that I understand the process that well. It seems as though it's a tar baby in a sense. Once you get in, like Hotel California, once you get in, you can't get out. And I'm not sure how that actually works. So. Counsel?
Ms. Russell, can I ask you a couple questions about your due process argument? Can you flesh that out for me, because I assume you're talking about the Fifth Amendment of the Federal Constitution.
Correct.
Due process. And do you know what case you would lay out the factors for determining whether due process has been provided? Because my understanding would be Matthews versus Eldridge is kind of a seminal case.
That sounds correct.
And have you reviewed any of the case law on whether ex parte restraining orders have been upheld under the Fifth Amendment's due process challenges?
Not with respect to the firearm prohibition.
Is it your belief that there must be a contested hearing to provide due process?
With respect to the firearm prohibition, it is our position that it would be when you're restricting someone's constitutional right to bear arms, that there would be a due process requirement.
maybe after the hearing we can look at some cases that I think would say that due process is satisfied if there is an opportunity for a contested hearing and there's a judge making explicit factors.
I think perhaps we're at a confusion. I would agree with that position. What I'm saying is that there's an opportunity for a hearing at which the respondent is present. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying any more than that.
Maybe we should look at the case law after the hearing. Also, and I want to make it, if I can continue, the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment right to bear arms, would you believe it would apply to this situation of an individual's right to bear arms in Oregon under the Ninth Circuit's decisions about whether that's an individual or collective right?
And I'm not certain on that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be, so far in the Ninth Circuit, they've found that that's a collective right for the state. It's an unpopular decision, I think. But
the Ninth Circuit's often wrong.
Well, also, there's case law dating back 50 years. There's very little case law under the Second Amendment, but the case law that does exist also at the federal level defines the rights under the Second Amendment as collective rights, not individual rights. And the Oregon Constitution is, of course, a little bit different.
Okay, so I think we can get the lawyers to get together and pull it all together and do some analysis so that we understand better what the constitutional issues we're facing are.
I have two questions.
I guess Senator Waters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, could you tell me, I'm just curious, because we got the report on the rancher who testified, and the spouse had her teeth knocked out with a lamp. Mm-hmm. So there's always a little bit more to the story than you hear. But I see a lot of these situations. I mean, I watched my father was an alcoholic, and he beat the heck out of my mother all mm-hmm. the time, knocking mm-hmm. her down the stairs and stuff, and she'd try to defend herself. There are situations where the spouses and the significant others mm-hmm. both may have alcoholic problems and fight and do whatever they do to each other, beat the hell out of each other. But is there a situation where mutual restraining orders are issued by the court and where we would dispossess both of them of firearms? Have that been used?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, there are circumstances where there are cross petitions in which both parties have restraining orders against one another. That does exist, and I believe that there is a bill that's been introduced on the House side by Representative Prozanski, which would make that as a matter. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm incorrect. I believe there's a bill that's been introduced on the Senate side by Senator Gordley that would make that an automatic requirement. That is to say, the restrictions would automatically apply to both parties.
Currently, it doesn't
automatically apply, but the judge can entertain two petitions at the same time, and there are situations that do exist where both parties to a domestic dispute are restrained, one against the other.
Mm-hmm.
And one other comment in terms of when you were talking, the example about a lamp that I just wanted to point out is that any time under current law that a weapon is used, and a weapon is, as I say, broad and would include a lamp, the conviction itself would not be for assault in the fourth degree. The conviction would be assault in the second degree, which is a felony. And any time it's a domestic case where a weapon is used, because it's a felony, firearm prohibitions currently apply. All convicted felons are restricted in Oregon law from possessing firearms. So any domestic case that has serious physical injury or that involves a weapon, those are currently covered. The only thing we're talking about in this that would be added is assault in the fourth degree as misdemeanor, so,
okay.
Which is your standard sort of the smallest level of violence in which there is physical injury, so it's not serious physical injury, and no weapon or other item is being used.
But that's after conviction.
After conviction, when, correct.
Right. Okay, and then my second question, if I might, Madam Chair, is one of the things we heard testimony about on, what day is this, Wednesday, Monday, was how easy it is to renew the restraining order. And again, it was the gentleman who knocked his wife's teeth out whose wife is a criminal herself, and he said it was real easy for her to get a renewal. Would it be better to put some more restrictions on the ease of getting that renewal? Put some kind of parameters around that so that the respondent has another opportunity to be heard?
Senator Walker, I believe under current law that if it is being renewed, the respondent would have an opportunity for a hearing. It would be a new restraining order or be continued. But I certainly think that is a legitimate point, and I think that it's worth looking at if there are ways that these cases, rather than sort of continuing just because they exist, can be reassessed in terms of whether this is a continuing ongoing problem or whether it's simply an order being continued because of past behavior that is no longer at issue. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a legitimate.
And is the timeline for most restraining orders or all of them a year generally?
Senator Walker, I believe the maximum is a year, and my experience has been is that is
the rule.
I think judges have discretion; they could do it for less, but I think that's pretty much what happens.
All right, thank you.
Are there other questions by the committee? I had a question, Special. When I first learned about these bills, I was told that the purpose was to kind of close a loophole, if you will, that in Oregon, because of our unique domestic violence statutes, that the gun prohibition that's present, already adopted in the federal statute, was sometimes not being put into effect in Oregon. And I guess I have a kind of a two-part question. Do you consider that's a good policy to have that if due process concerns can be met? And secondly, do you have any suggestions on how we could effectively do that in Oregon if you don't like the approach of Senate Bill 49?
Ms. Vice Chair, I think that with respect to the other two bills, Senate Bill 300 and 303, that those bills are addressing concerns that Oregon law has, as you said, loopholes or missing pieces that have prevented federal prosecution. And Senate Bill 49, I think, is also part of the package, and that it is presenting an alternative to federal prosecution of making a crime under Oregon law, which would be a Class A misdemeanor punishable by up to a year in jail. So those are kind of two alternatives. I think that the bills are trying to do both things, make it possible for federal prosecution by correcting the problems or the limitations that have made prosecution impossible under certain circumstances, and at the same time providing an alternative state remedy. And so I think that's a policy decision in terms of whether it is preferable for federal prosecution or state prosecution. It's my understanding that federal prosecution has higher penalties. If a prosecution is going to be taken, it has higher penalties. And so that's always a concern to our organization.
Now, when you talk about a bill that would make it more consistent for federal prosecution, you're talking about Senate Bill 300 and 303.
Correct. In terms of, it's my understanding that there's certain that the federal. I'm talking about those two bills and the concerns that the federal law is more restrictive in terms of that there must be have had an opportunity for a hearing, that there is concern in terms of there has to be a determined or that there's not an adequate determination that the case involved domestic violence. And so Senate Bill 300 and 303, it's my understanding, are aimed at remedying those perceived shortcomings.
To make it more possible to have federal prosecution.
Correct.
Now, as a general policy matter, and you made a good distinction between those two approaches, if you could have your choice of a federal making things more consistent for federal prosecution versus trying to adopt a system where we would have state prosecutions, in other words, track the federal law, but have the prosecution authority at the state level, which of those policies do you think would make the most sense?
And I don't think, Vice Chair, I don't think I can give a determinative answer on that. I think there are advantages to there are certain advantages in terms of these kind of cases to ensuring that the potential liability for the actor is not excessive or is proportional to the type of conduct. And of course, our concern with the federal gun provisions is that that the penalties are quite. I believe that there are generally greater than what would be apply in a state proceeding. So that, of course, is our concerns with federal prosecution for these type of cases. As a general, which is better? I don't think that I can say, and I think that I don't know if our organization has a position. We have concerns with both systems.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee, counsel? Ms. Meyer, are you going to testify today?
Vice Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. I actually have very little to add. I think you've had Ms. Russell has pretty much articulated our concerns with Senate Bill 49. ACLU of Oregon is comfortable with Senate Bill 300. We're concerned with the due process issues not being fully or adequately addressed in Senate Bill 49 and more appropriately addressed in Senate Bill 300.
So it's the ACLU's concerns are in the due process end of things and not in terms of the policy of conforming with federal law on firearm prohibitions.
Correct.
Thank you.
And Ms. Meyer, if I can ask a question, could you help me out with that due process argument? I know there's a due process issue whenever guns are taken away, I think, but can you explain what, if you're saying that you believe an ex parte order violates it, if there's an opportunity to be heard about it within 30 days?
Mr. Prinz, I actually have not had an opportunity to look at the case law. What we feel strongly about is that there has to be the opportunity to be heard and the notice and meaningful notice and the opportunity to be heard. I haven't had an opportunity to look at the case law in terms of, I think, what you're speaking of, which is the removal during the pendency prior to the actual hearing occurring. If that's the nugget of which you're focusing on, I wasn't.
Ms. Usher, can I just follow up? I think there's a difference between a due process issue and a violation of due process, and I think I want to flesh that out. And I believe, the case law is clear that if there isn't a due process violation in a situation like this, from my review. But I wanted to see if you believe that as well.
One further question, maybe for both of you: the concerns over the assault for conviction, the prohibition going into effect for an assault for prohibition involving domestic violence. Right now, it's against the law in Oregon to sell a gun, for a dealer to sell a gun to a person who has any kind of misdemeanor, violent misdemeanor conviction. Is your concern about the assault for the permanency of the gun ban, or is it the fact that a gun ban would go into effect at all?
And Ms. Fischer, our concern, in addition to the notice issues that we've talked about, our concern would be that the length of the prohibition, as well as the across-the-board prohibition, which is not specific or tailored to the circumstances of the case. That's so that so many different types of behavior can result in assault for conviction. I think Senator Walker suggested that when she was talking about in reference to discussion about what the actual conviction is. So an assault for could be a more aggravated assault that's actually pled down and results in assault for conviction, and it could be behavior that is reckless and more de minimis and starts out that way. So there is a concern that a real wide variety of behavior would fall into this, where the individual might have very legitimate reasons to own firearms, such as hunting, or maybe the individual works as a security officer and has a history of respect for the firearm. So I think that blanket prohibition under Oregon law, without looking at the specifics or giving a judge the individual discretion to exempt a case from this prohibition given the circumstances, if the court determines that this really is not a concern.
So your concern is the prohibition at all, or the length of the prohibition?
The length of the prohibition and the fact that it's a blanket prohibition.
Thank you. Are there further questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Our next witness is Nick Coffey. Welcome, Mr. Coffey.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm going to be quite brief. I'm speaking in opposition to this bill, and I have two serious concerns related to it.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
Yeah, Nick Coffey. I live here in Salem. I have two concerns about this bill. One of them is that by bringing these due process issues into a restraining order process, that eventually what we're going to do is we're going to make it hard to get restraining orders. I don't feel like it should be hard to get restraining orders. I think restraining orders should be issued with a minimum of evidence and proof. I think women or anyone in a family who feels threatened ought to be able to get a restraining order fairly quickly. And I think when you start taking people's rights and property away, then you owe them due process. And I think you owe them more than a hearing. I think you owe them a hearing where they're represented by counsel and they can follow the rules of evidence and appear before a judge and have a ruling made like any other criminal process. We're talking about depriving people of property and depriving people of rights. So I would urge you to reconsider this. I think if you built enough due process into it to satisfy us, then what's going to happen is you have weakened the whole process of getting a restraining order too much, and I don't want to see that happen. You know, I've seen restraining order process abused. My son was involved in an argument with his girlfriend that was witnessed. He wasn't the one who was violent, and there were mutual restraining orders for a couple of weeks, and it was not a situation where either person really should have lost anything. So we know that those kinds of things happen. And I think that's okay as long as we're not taking too much away from people. You know, err on the side of caution. Have the restraining order in cases where there's doubt. Don't take away people's rights and property when you do it, so that we don't really create too rigid a standard for getting them in the first place.
Mr. Coffey, have you had a chance to review both of the bills, Senate Bill 49?
No, I've just really had a chance to look at 49 so far.
Because at least in the case of Senate Bill 300, it's very easy, continues to be very easy to get a restraining order, but the property involved, the firearms, can't be confiscated unless there's been a request for a contested hearing where people's due process is, you know, that's the forum for the due process to be exercised. Does that reassure you at all, that process? In other words, an example you gave, there would be no change in the readiness to issue a restraining order, but to get to the next step of taking away property, there would have to be this opportunity for a contested hearing. Does that reassure you?
Well, in that process of a contested hearing, then would the person involved in the contested hearing have counsel, and would the hearing follow the regular rules of evidence that are used in a criminal proceedings, and would the same same standards be held as in a criminal process?
Vice Chairman, Mr. Coffey, there would not be an appointment, you don't have a right to an attorney. You could have one at your own expense, but there's no right to an attorney because it's not a criminal case. It's a civil process for the restraining order. The evidence rules do apply. And as I believe Ms. Russell said, the evidence standard is preponderance of the evidence so that the petitioner would have to prove that.
Well, conditionally, that might make me feel more comfortable. I'll have to look at that one. I don't know. Okay, but if that's really what you're saying, is if you're saying, I don't understand then why we have SB 49. Then if you're saying, well, we're going to have a process where a person who might be deprived of their rights and their property is going to have a hearing, why have this other process?
Right. And there are different approaches to the different bills, and that's why I was asking if you had a chance to.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I think that's worth considering. I need to look at that. I don't know. Okay. But I will. I'm a little concerned that our legislative council or our committee council is deferring to the Ninth Court. I mean, I think Oregon law is a lot more clear that Second Amendment is an individual right. I don't think we need to defer to the Ninth Court. I think we're in a time when we have civil liberty sort of across the board, all 10 amendments eroding rather rapidly, and I think we're concerned about that as a whole. And you know, I think we've seen times in the past when case law supported slavery, and times in the past when case law supported the doctrine of separate but equal. So there's a lot of bad case law over the years accumulates in times when civil liberties are being challenged, and I think that may be the case right now. So I don't really want to see us following the Ninth Court too heavily in this matter.
Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Powell.
Thank you.
Okay, we, Mr. Harder is not signed up, so you can't speak, Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question of our committee counsel?
Sure.
I was wondering if you could clarify. It's my understanding that the judge, in exercising the discretion as to whether to impose a restraining order, upon issuing the restraining order, whether there's a firearm restriction, there is no discretion. The firearms would be excluded.
Ms. Vice Chairman, Senator Ring, I think that's not accurate. I think that there's two concepts that we might, it's easy to get confused. One is, this is a civil restraining order.
That's right.
And so there'd be an enforcement through contempt. And it's my understanding that the prohibition against gun possession under the court's contempt powers is discretionary. And I think it's not issued any time. If anyone would care to agree or disagree, I think it's under the other relief portion of a restraining order, so that there are boxes to check that say you basically cannot abuse, you cannot go to, you know.
I see.
So it would be
okay.
Other relief. That's a contempt power. That is not a crime, then, if you violate that, as you know. You know, this, I think it's 6 months that a judge could put you in jail, though, for contempt at the most extreme. The other issue is then, I think Senate Bill 49 makes it a crime if there's that restraining order in place. So kind of two different.
So under the structure of Senate Bill 49, there would not be discretion.
Vice Chairman Burdick, Senator Ringo, correct. I mean, the discretion, would be a prosecutorial discretion whether to prosecute a crime, but it's the way it's laid out. It says if there is a restraining order that's been issued, and there's, I think under the -2 amendment, it says, and there's been an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So once that opportunity has passed, and either the respondent chose not to do the hearing, or did the hearing and the respondent failed, so the petition remained,
right.
Or excuse me, the restraining order remained, then it's a crime.
Okay.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. That my colleague Senator Ringo's question, I think, was a good question. Let me see if I understood the answer. There is currently vested in the judiciary all the discretion to take or not to take action with respect to firearms in a case of a requested restraining order. That is what I just heard. Judges currently have this power.
Ms. Vice Chairman Burdick, Senator Perry. Sorry, that's correct. That's my understanding.
Okay, I just want to be really clear for the record that this law creates no new authority with respect to the discretion the judge has.
Senator Perry,
however, this law, if passed, would remove discretion from the judge. If a restraining order was sought and assaultive behavior was proved and firearms were present.
Sir Ferriola, I think you're mixing two issues. This does not in any way touch the judge's contempt powers.
Okay.
But it does make it unlawful and a crime to possess a firearm after the way Senate Bill 49 reads, after that contested hearing time has passed. So in no way touching the contempt powers in another realm of law, in criminal law, it would criminalize that possession. So, do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, and then the issue now becomes whether or not there's due process and a consequence that may be unintended or unanswerable in a civil process. But I'm still getting at this issue now, Chairman. The idea that the judges currently have the discretion to do or not to do is the issue for me in this case. They currently have all the authority to include in their restraining order prohibition against possession of firearms.
Maybe we can.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that is just for the record. Judges have this authority.
And maybe we could bring back some of the earlier witnesses and learn, if they have that discretion, why it hasn't been used or what they perceive the problem to be. We'll wind around on that, but we would not want to miss an opportunity to hear Mr. Harder speak first. Welcome, Rod.
Madam Chair, I'm the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder, the National Rifle Association representative for Oregon. I had some very good testimony, but I'm so confused now by the recent conversations, I'm not sure I can deliver it. I think I would start with the federal law. And the federal law is very specific and has considerably more protections in it than are offered in either 49 or 300. And I am not conversant on the third bill that's being heard today, so I'm only going to speak to 49 and 300. Under federal law, you cannot be dispossessed of your firearms until there is a hearing. And what I have heard, I think what I've heard is that these bills would allow petitioner to demand a hearing. Under federal law, only the respondent can demand a hearing, and we view that not as a loophole in federal law, but as a protection. before you can, and federal law allows, upon conviction of a misdemeanor involving domestic violence, removal of your firearm privileges for life. There are protections built into the federal law which say you are entitled to counsel, you are entitled to a trial. And the analogy that was, and being a layman, I asked our counsel in Washington to come up with some of these things for me. I understand that in many misdemeanor cases where people are indigent and there is no, and I am probably going to be corrected on this, but where people are indigent and there is no indication that there will be incarceration, that those people sometimes are not represented by counsel for misdemeanors. I could be wrong on that, but that's what my counsel advises me. With regards to the bills, we heard testimony that in Oregon there are 14,000 restraining orders issued a year, and that is a very large number. We agree with Mr. Coffey that restraining orders should be issued in the interest of safety. There should not be, at least initially, any hesitation on the part of a judge if somebody's life is in danger or if their physical well-being is in danger. But what we're talking about is not revocation of a fishing or revocation of a driver's license or suspension of a driver's license. We're talking about a constitutional right, something that's guaranteed in the Constitution, and it should be, and I have now heard that it is protected by due process. in the and I have spent considerable time with a divorce attorney here, unfortunately, and several, and they've all told me that restraining order is not only easy to come by, but if you go to a hearing, you can plan on the judge saying, basically, Mr. Jones, did you beat your wife? No. Mr. Jones, are you ever going to beat your wife? No. Well, then this restraining order won't be a problem, will it? And the hearing is over, and as Mr. The gentleman who testified on Monday articulated, that evidence was brought in by his spouse. She was heard, and when it got to be his turn, the judge said, I heard enough. The hearing's over. You lose. I think that from the information I've been able to gather, that is not an uncommon thing, that these things, that the rules of evidence may apply, but most often, or most sometimes, not most often, I don't know that, but often they do not fully consider all the rules of evidence in arriving at the decision, and they don't conduct it as a trial, they conduct it as a hearing. And it's our contention that if you're going to lose a constitutional right, then rules of evidence should be followed and conducted, the hearing conducted, as if it were a trial. One other thing that comes to mind, counsel just said to Mr. Coffey that there was no right to counsel in a hearing because it was a civil hearing, and then I just heard him say that it becomes a crime if you retain possession of your firearms after you're told you couldn't. So I guess I know where that went and where, but it doesn't seem right to me that you're going to become a criminal if you don't do something, but you don't have right to counsel in the process to put that puts you there. I think that other people have pretty much articulated what I was going to say, and I would be interested in continuing the process and have an opportunity to testify after much of this gets ironed out. And with that, I would close mine for now and answer any questions.
Thank you. You said that at the federal level, and I think counsel might have something to say on this. He's left the room. He had a couple of comments on some of the legal points he brought up. But you said that having only the respondent being able to request a hearing was a protection. And I was just wondering what you saw as the problem with having the petitioner be able to request a hearing.
Chair Burdick, yes. We have heard testimony and discussion, not necessarily testimony, we've heard discussion about frivolous restraining orders being filed. And let's say that there was a pecuniary interest involved and the restraining order was filed on the pretense of domestic violence, and this is... And again, from my attorneys, I knew that this was not an uncommon thing. We then have the person who is filing that frivolous complaint being able to come back and demand a hearing on it. And in the process, the individual could lose his right to firearms. So our concern there is that you have a person filing the complaint being able to come back and demand a hearing so firearms can be taken away. That's not the case under federal law.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you asked that question because it was on my notepad, too. And I'm sorry, Mr. Harder, your answer didn't make sense to me. Because if the petitioner requests a hearing and the respondent has to come and the evidence is presented to the judge that he is a risk to the petitioner, why shouldn't his firearm be taken away? I don't understand where the protection is. I guess I'm confused. What?
You referred to the
Senator.
I was just wondering.
Oh, I know. I keep doing that. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I just wondered about that.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker.
I'll be gender neutral here. I'm coming off of my sister's incident, so that's why I keep saying that. But I apologize. It could be male, female. So explain to me. I'm very confused about your argument.
Mr.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Actually, could we just hear from counsel for a second, and then...
Vice Chair, Mr. Hart, I wanted to maybe correct you on one thing about the federal statute, which is under... This is... The federal statute says that the prohibition against firearms is only applicable after a hearing of which the subject was notified and at which the subject had an opportunity to participate. In Oregon law, only the respondent requests a contested hearing, but that's not a requirement of the federal law. To clarify this, in Oregon, you could get a ex parte order, I mean an order just by yourself, and if the respondent never requests a hearing, then that order just stays. So there never was a contested hearing, but that's a valid restraining order. So I just wanted to make that clear that the federal law doesn't say that only the respondent can request it. It just says it's only the federal prohibition is only applicable after, I'll read it again, I'll quote it, after a hearing of which the subject, meaning respondent, was notified and at which the subject had an opportunity to participate.
Now, I'm sure I stand corrected, and that's what my paper says. I read it wrong.
And just to continue the record, isn't the fact that at the federal level, the hearing is automatic. Is that correct? At the state level, the hearing does not take place unless it's requested by the respondent. I believe
Mr. Senator, I'm going to try this again. Vice Chairperson Burdick, just to be gender neutral. These federal prohibitions are applicable to states, the state laws. So I think the issue is that in Oregon, the way our process works for getting a restraining order, a FAPA restraining order, which incidentally is there are other restraining orders, like in a divorce. This is for a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order, which may have different standards than a divorce restraining order. Because of the way our statute works, and again, that ours, it's not like there is a temporary restraining order and then you automatically have a contested hearing. In Oregon, you could have one order at an ex parte hearing, and that's it, unless the respondent requests that hearing. So there's a difference in each state on that. But there is no automatic contested hearing in Oregon, to answer your question. I think the states apply this in each case.
Yes, I think that's a good clarification. Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, back to Senator Walker's question. Senator Walker, I think I still remember the question. Senator Farioli pointed out, and I am familiar with the form, there is a block on there where the judge can check you can lose your firearms there. And in that case, then the respondent had the ability to come back and argue that. That, to mine, and I have asked some of the proponents, or not of these particular bills, but of like bills that are kind of popping up everywhere, and their argument was that judges are not consistent in doing that. So I think that that's a good place to start and find out, number one, if they can do it regularly, and if so, why they're not, rather than passing an additional piece of legislation.
Okay. I guess it's going to take some time for me to process, but Mr. Harder, I guess the question I want to ask you is, do you think the petitioner, and I don't know what your answer was earlier, do you think the petitioner should have the right to request a hearing, which is what is being asked for in Senate Bill 300?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, if I were comfortable with the process, if I were comfortable with what due process consists of in a restraining order, then I would be comfortable in answering your question affirmatively, but I am not at all comfortable with the way things happen in restraining order hearings.
And
until that can be clarified and taken care of, then my answer is no, I wouldn't.
And I think your testimony that I wrote down here was that you felt the judge often, you cited the case that we had earlier where he said that the judge listened to all of her arguments and then had heard enough and didn't allow him an opportunity to be heard. Now, I don't know that for a fact. That's only what he testified to in our hearing. But is that your sense, that there's not complete due process here and the judge will only hear part of the argument?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So just that
clarifies it for me.
Thank you, Senator Walker. So just to clarify, and counsel can help me out here, I think, as I understand it, the problem that we're addressing here, and we're going to bring the sponsors back to more clearly define the problem, is that Oregon's law, because it does allow the ex parte restraining order, and it only stays in effect if a hearing has been offered and either taken up on or not. In other words, we don't have a temporary restraining order and then an automatic hearing in Oregon. Our process. So you stick with me here for a second. As I understand the problem, if we had a situation where in order to get a permanent restraining order, a hearing was automatically required, would that solve your concerns?
Madam Chair, my answer to that is the same as the one I gave Senator Walker. What took place at the hearing would have to be visited. And I think it would have to be very specific as to either right to counsel, no right to counsel. As I read the bills, that you could have your attorney there at your own expense. But I would not be comfortable with answering that question as I responded to Senator Walker until I see what's going to happen at that hearing.
Correct. And the bills do not deal with what happens at a hearing one way or the other.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Thank you, Mr. Harder. Maybe we could call back Mr. Niebel and Commissioner Nato to kind of remind us of what the problem is here and specifically address the point that came up about the judges already having discretion, and address Senator Ferrioli's concern about why we need this bill in the first place.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. First of all, I would agree with Senator Ferrioli's characterization that judges now, under current law, under a provision that says that the judge in making an ex parte order under the Family Abuse Prevention Act has the authority to enter orders that for the protection of the petitioner and or the children. And that includes specific, the language in the statute doesn't mention firearm dispossession, but I think it's clear that the judge does have discretion to enter an order saying that the respondent is not allowed to possess firearms while the restraining order is in effect or until it's modified. So I agree with Senator Ferrioli, the point that he makes. In Multnomah County, I think many orders are issued with that prohibition, or a substantial proportion of the orders, I believe, are issued with that prohibition. I think in other counties that the percentage of orders that are entered with that prohibition is less, because I think, I don't know for how to characterize it other than for cultural reasons. I think that there's more reluctance on the part of the court to make that order. I think in Multnomah County also that the restraining order packet that a petitioner fills out has a place to specifically request that relief in the order, and I think that varies around the state. I don't think that's the case in all counties. So the court does have that inherent power to order that now. If the respondent disagrees, the respondent may ask for a hearing now to contest the restraining order or to contest that particular part of it. With respect to the need for this bill, I agree with what Mr. Prinz said about the federal law and the state law. Federal law requires federal law says that a respondent is not allowed to have firearms after a restraining order is entered and the respondent has had notice of the order and an opportunity for a hearing on, or and actually after a hearing at which the respondent had an opportunity to appear. That is actually the procedure in most other states. I think it's over 40 states have a procedure. In fact, I think it's more like 48 states have a procedure where there is an automatic hearing in every restraining order case. So in almost every other state, the entry of a restraining order after the hearing invokes federal law. It implicates federal law. In Oregon, however, because we have this odd, with respect to the other states, we have this procedure that varies, where the respondent is served and then the respondent has the opportunity to ask for a hearing, and if the respondent doesn't ask for a hearing, then the restraining order is simply continued in effect. The gun dispossession provisions don't take effect unless the respondent has requested a hearing. So what Senate Bill 300 does is it allows a petitioner who wants the protection of the federal law to request a hearing, of which the respondent would get notice and an opportunity to be heard. And after that hearing has happened, whether or not the respondent chooses to appear, the federal gun dispossession provisions would apply. And that's what Senate Bill 300 is seeking to do.
Okay, so to clarify, under the judge's discretion now, if there is a provision like in Multnomah County where they specify gun dispossession during the restraining order period, that is a state requirement. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. That would be a violation. That would be a, if that were violated, that would be, the person who violated it would be liable for contempt of court.
And the federal penalties are stiffer for violation of the gun dispossession requirement. So what this bill is for is to kick in the federal requirements.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Does that answer your question, Senator Ayala?
Actually, Madam Chairman, I was off on a different topic. The question that occurs to me is that Oregon's Constitution is very specific on the right to keep and bear arms for personal defense. It's much different than the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And with respect to this issue of including an automatic provision for gun seizure in a restraining order, it isn't a matter of limiting the rights to, for instance, drive a car, which isn't a constitutionally guaranteed right. But it is a matter of limiting a constitutional right to keep and bear arms for personal defense. And it seems to be a much different matter, a much more serious matter in terms of the limitation of a constitutional right. And so I'm really concerned about this due process question. The due process would be a much greater necessity in my mind for an issue that limits a constitutional guarantee than one that just limits a privilege. And so the due process question to me is very central to this issue.
Thank you. Before we continue with that, Commissioner Bonanno, did you have anything to add about
these get so complicated, and just to summarize where I think we are.
Could you state your name for the record?
For the record, Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner. It was our intent in Senate Bill 49 to add a state remedy, a state criminal remedy, where there is a valid order for dispossession of guns, but also to parallel the federal requirements. It was not our intention to limit the discretion or change the discretion of the judges at those hearings, but where they are ordered to be dispossessed of a gun, that would then become a potential
Criminal Act, and partly to give certainty to the police in enforcing any search and seizure provisions and in their carrying out their duties to have that ability to enforce that order beyond the civil contempt possibility under state law, while it may already exist under federal law. We support the bill allowing the petitioner the right to request a hearing. Our bill was to try to mirror the federal law to provide that hearing opportunity exist before there would be dispossession of gun to satisfy any concern over due process requirements. We can't order the courts in their hearings to, you know, we have to assume that the courts are carrying out their duties in terms of due process, allowing parties to speak, following the rules of evidence. I think that has to be a given under just our assumptions as we move forward with state law, that the opportunities of due process afforded at a hearing would be granted to the parties. So that's where we are. I do think the bills can work in parallel, and I realize there's all these, the thing's always more complicated than you think. We've also been talking with the police associations. We had talked with them earlier, but to look at the federal exemption for line of duty requirements for gun possession and factor that in as possible, try to parallel that, what if that exists in validly, which we're trying to research, I understand.
Thank you very much. Council,
I appreciate very much the discussion we're having here. The due process requires a hearing. And I got word from the county court in Washington County yesterday that between now and the end of this biennium, there'll be 4,000 cases unheard because of the inadequate time in the courts. We had testimony here early in this presentation from a judge who also raised the issue of tying up the court's time with due process hearings. I think that fundamentally we're going down a track here that's counterproductive in a lot of ways, in that we've got much more opportunity to protect the public if we are able to prosecute dangerous criminals. My sense of this whole thing is that, in fact, we're not protecting people by taking away guns. We just we've got to understand that very often citizens are protecting themselves with those guns. And we've seen where removal of guns have increased violent crime because no criminals no longer have any cure. This is gun control legislation, and I cannot accept it personally as anything else. So I'll be opposing these bills for that reason. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Lisa. Question on Senate Bill 49. You know, the criminal defense lawyers have requested that there ought to be a measure of discretion in this bill. And the way it operates right now, at least the way I read it, is that there isn't a discretion. That if there's a restraining order under ORS 107.716, that's considered a violation. And
that is, Chairman, Senator Ringo, we were not attempting to interfere with the discretion of the court, but simply make it where it has been ordered to be dispossessed. And if that's unclear from the current language, then it would need to be amended to make that clear. I agree with that.
Okay,
as to the other issue of our of working with our law enforcement as chair of our local public safety coordinating council, domestic violence crime is a very large part of the work that is public safety. And I just can't say enough that person-to-person crimes in a family are a very serious matter for law enforcement and for prosecution. I know our chief presiding judge has indicated that domestic violence is a high priority. These restraining orders are already filed to protect people from violence within their family, and the majority of murders involving domestic violence involve firearms. And so it is a very serious matter, and it, where there's been proven to a judge that someone is at risk and there's firearms there, then I think it should be up to the judge to protect that person as far as possible, and certainly we won't be able to in every instance, but to make sure that a person is protected and has the police support behind them to enforce a restraining order.
Before we get to one question, did you have a comment on the points that were made before that we can go down? I'm just concerned about
Vice that. Chairman Burdick, I had one point to make that Mr. DeLashment wanted me to make, and I would be remiss if I didn't. There are exceptions. There's some confusion in the federal law as to what exceptions there are currently for law enforcement officers, and we're working on clarifying that, which will take hopefully just a few hours of my time, but it's these exceptions have been amended up to 2 weeks ago, the federal laws. Secondly, I wanted to say that under the federal, there was some issue that came up, I think Mr. Harder brought it up. In Senate Bill 49, there's a portion that relates to a person who's been convicted of a misdemeanor assault. They would be prohibited from having firearms. I want to make it clear that in Oregon, only if the defendant had been given the opportunity to have counsel and had knowingly and intentionally waived that right to counsel would a prior conviction be valid. And that's the same as in the federal prohibitions as well, if that makes sense. So I wanted to make sure that was clarified.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess I'm coming back full circle again on this thing. Everybody opens their testimony by acknowledging that judges already have the authority. I haven't heard any convincing evidence that judges are reluctant to seize firearms if they think that's protective and make that order. And I haven't been given any evidence that police are reluctant to carry out that order. So are judges refusing to consider firearm seizures in cases where we're seeing a specification of that issue in restraining orders petitions, and are cops not enforcing the orders once they're given? That's what I'm interested in.
Senator Menes, Ted Farrelly, and David might be able to add on to my answer to that. My understanding is right now they have a civil contempt power, which the police may or may not recognize as a valid order. It's been unclear in our county whether police have search and seizure powers to actually enforce these orders. We don't, because it's not clear under state law, and oftentimes it's not clear under federal law whether the federal law applies because of this, the way the restraining orders are given automatically without the hearing notice that's required under the federal law. So we are an anomaly with and the U.S. attorney has indicated that they can't prosecute federally the cases because it's unclear about the due process requirements in the state. And what we are trying to do is clarify the due process and opportunities for requesting hearings so that we can get coverage under the federal laws, and we are also trying to parallel the state laws so it's clear that there's a state law remedy if the federal prosecutor chooses not to enforce. We do have a state law right.
I just wanted to clarify, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Senator Farrelly, I don't believe that this bill would result in law enforcement officials appearing on the doorsteps of people with restraining orders, or against whom restraining orders have been issued, with search warrants to search their homes for guns. I think, for one thing, I don't think that the law would support that. Senate Bill 300, remember, it would make this a crime under federal law, so that would be a matter for the U.S. Marshals to enforce. I believe that is not, I don't think that they have the resources to do that. So I don't think, I think that it's important to distinguish between seizure, which is a word that I believe you use, Senator Farioli, and prohibition, which is a directive to the person with the guns saying, you may not have these. The effect of Senate Bill 300, as I think we've tried to point out, is that it would be contempt of court to the effect of possessing a gun after you've been ordered to get rid of them by a judge in a Family Abuse Prevention Act order would be contempt of court, but it wouldn't be a crime. And I think that that's an important distinction to make.
Thank you. Are there other questions for the committee? Mr. Chairman, do you have any questions?
No questions.
Chair is silent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this? If not, public hearing on Senate Bill 49, Senate Bill 300, and Senate Bill 303 is closed.
Lunch with the Superior Court.
Yeah, where are we going? Your office, or? Rendezvous at 3. Are you at 11?